Welcome to another episode of the Mama Bear Dares podcast. We feature regular moms who you've maybe sat next to at a PTA meeting or seen in the aisles of Target with maybe a screaming toddler in the cart. We interview moms who have taken initiative to make their own nonprofits from their Lego-laced living rooms, or they've come out on the other side of losing a loved one, or they've carved out time to produce breathtaking art. We want to talk to all of them and dive in deep to conversations that make these women more than mom. We boldly ask the questions that we've all been thinking, and we welcome you to today's episode. On today's episode of Mama Bear Dares, we interview Cynthia Vanderpool Garcia, an immigration and nationality lawyer living and working in the Washington, D.C. area. We talk about family, about being a mom, and about immigration in our country. We are so excited to share this conversation with you, but first, Tessie, why don't you tell our listeners about our sponsors?
Today's episode is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at www.audible.com/mamabeardares. And just a reminder that we have our Amazon banner ad on our website. Make our website your favorite so that it's super easy to just click on the banner and get all of your Amazon purchases through that. It does not cost you anything extra, but does kick back a little extra change to the Mama Bear Dares podcast. So, Leslie, I was maybe a little selfish in wanting to talk to Cynthia because she and I somehow got connected because of our Ethiopian adoptions years and years ago. She's good friends with someone I actually traveled with to pick up Teriku. She's one of those Facebook people, and you have them as well, that always says really thought-provoking things, posts beautiful pictures of her family, and is just really intentional and intelligent. And I just was selfishly wanting to talk to her and get to know her more, but also thought our mama bears could learn a little something, as I have in watching her kind of move through the world as a mom and an immigration lawyer.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you did. I'm glad you invited her to the show. I definitely learned a lot in the conversation that we had with Cynthia. She really is a fascinating person. Mm-hmm. She's someone who has studied immigration law, both in the context of the classroom, but also it's become a part of her life, as her husband is actually from Ethiopia. So she has this really multi-layered perspective on immigration, and it's just such a fascinating topic right now, especially in our country. So it was great to get kind of firsthand perspective from Cynthia throughout our conversation. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I found really interesting that came from our conversation was the ways in which we can be intentional about bringing awareness to our kids in this world. So it's a huge, huge world. There are so many different kinds of people. And we had a good discussion, I felt, on the ways that we kind of expose our kids to other people and other cultures. It's something that's very important to me. And I was really happy to hear Cynthia's perspective on this. I think we should prime our mama bears for this conversation and just get them thinking about what they might do to experience different cultures, especially because many of our listeners live in areas of the country that aren't terribly diverse.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a hard line to walk. You don't want to be voyeuristic. You don't want to, you know, kind of use other cultures or people of color in a way that is really kind of icky, you know? Mm-hmm. But you and I both obviously know it's extremely important for our kids to know that their reality is not the reality, that there are people of all different colors, shapes, sizes, income levels in the world. And it can be pretty dangerous, really, to assume that your experience is the only experience.
Yeah. So what does this look like in your family, Tessie?
Well, I know for us, it's important to kind of expose them to music and books, now that they're older, blog posts that I find that is kind of at their level. You know, some of them obviously operate at a higher level than they'd be able to comprehend any of it. But doing that, going to, I mean, we talked on the podcast about going to museums. I think all of those are really important too. What about you?
Yeah, I was thinking about this since our conversation, and I think it's just always really been a priority for Jake and myself. When we first moved to our neighborhood here in our current city, we definitely looked for a neighborhood, and especially a neighborhood school, that had diversity. So I think we intentionally inserted ourselves into, you know, this society where there is some difference in terms of both socioeconomic status and race and religion. And so that was a really big commitment that we made to this. I mean, it definitely determined really our address, like where we're living. And another way that I'm obsessed with travel, and I love to travel, and I did not get on an airplane until I was in college. I had never gone anywhere growing up as a child. And it's something that we've really prioritized as a family. And I just can't even begin to tell you how crazy my kids' passports are. I mean, how crazy it is to me. But it's definitely a value for us. You know, we've taken the kids literally all over the world. And we've done this intentionally, and we've kind of sacrificed in other areas of our lives to make this a priority. We used to joke that, you know, we lived for like 7 years without a toaster. Like, we would broil our bread every morning. And my joke was always that, like, well, if we buy a toaster, how can we afford to go to Ethiopia next summer, you know? And of course, like, a toaster costs $20. But it's sort of just that, just making this a priority. We want to show our kids a bigger, really vast world in hopes that they understand people better and that they walk away with some compassion.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the travel element is important because that's not you just sitting at your table with plenty of food, with clean water, telling them they should care about people who don't have plenty of food, that don't have clean water, that aren't safe in their neighborhoods. It's really getting to see it at an age where they're able to not let any lens that they've heard our culture tell them how they're supposed to feel about it, but they just feel it, you know, at those ages. So travel, I agree, is so important. I also really liked our discussion on this episode with Cynthia. She said at one point, politicians seem to use the confusing nature of immigration to pander to their specific people. And I just thought that was so profound. I mean, it's obvious, but it's also profound because I like to believe in the inherent good nature of humanity, even though I watch House of Cards. So that does seem a little conflicting. But in some ways, it just surprised
me.
Oh,
man, that's dark. It's so dark.
It is. But it's got to be true, right? Because immigration is very confusing. And I felt like Cynthia broke it down for us in a really applicable way, first of all. You know, if you watch kind of the 24-hour news cycle or whatever, there are no shortage of experts. And I say that in quotes, right? Experts on immigration. But even for me, who has navigated kind of the world of immigration with regards to our adoption, because obviously we did have to get the boys immigrated into the country, the whole thing is still baffling, right? I mean, I remember you and I talking, like, are we getting the CR3, the CR4? How do our kids come in? What do we need to do after it? It's a really confusing system. But I thought Cynthia really broke it down so that our mama bears will understand it just a little bit better. And even if they don't understand it, understand that if anyone out there tries to claim it's as black and white as they get in the country and then they sign the papers and then it's done, they'll be able to see that as a lie.
Yeah, I mean, she provides great education, for sure, in a really personal way about a really complex system.
Well, at one point she says, my favorite part is that the world gets to come to me, right? Like, I'm sitting at a desk in the DC area, but the world comes to me. And I was thinking about how, you know, she would tell stories on her Facebook or in this episode about what she's seeing as an immigration lawyer. And it kind of reminded me of what was said in Jody's podcast, just about, you know, the immigrant mom is trying to make a better life for her kids and is no different than me. And Sarah mentioned this on her podcast too. We'll link to both in the show notes, but you know, I would do the same thing. Like, we are all connected. And I think Cynthia did a good job of saying, you know, kind of why the whole immigration issue is a big deal anyway, because we forget that these are people. Mm-hmm. And we tried to make them a statistic.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to recommend a book to our listeners called Americana, and it's written by a Nigerian woman who now lives and teaches in this country. But it's a piece of fiction, so, you know, I love the what you were talking about, just, you know, learning about others through art. Mm-hmm. This book, I think, does just a fantastic job of humanizing the immigration story. Mm-hmm. Currently, you know, what does an immigrant from, in this case, Nigeria, what do they experience in 2016? What does it look like? And even though this, you know, it's a made up story, I think it just, it sheds light on the real hardship that a lot of people face. It forces you to kind of think, gosh, how would I fare in that situation? And it just kind of stretches our levels, or it stretches our ability to be compassionate.
Yeah. Did you see her, the author of that book's TED Talk as well?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was really amazing. We need to link to that as well.
Yeah. For sure.
Yeah. She's got some really beautiful things to say, heartbreaking, but also beautiful and poignant. But, you know, I just thought, I don't even think we need to really prep our listeners all that much, because Cynthia does such a good job anyway. So I don't know. I think I'm ready. Did you want to say anything else? Are you ready?
No, let's get into it. This is great. Enjoy the conversation, Mama Bears.
Hey, Mama Bears. Today we are talking to Cynthia Vanderpool Garcia. Immigration is a hot button issue in America right now, but at Mama Bear Dares, we aren't interested in getting into political wars. We want to hear actual stories of who is affected by the political wars. So today we welcome Cynthia, an immigration and nationality lawyer based out of Washington, D.C. When she's not championing the rights of other people's families, she's spending time with her own family, which includes a husband and two sons. So, Cynthia, welcome to the Mama Bear Dares podcast.
Hi, you guys. Hi, Tessie. Hi, Leslie. It's nice to be here with you guys.
You too.
Thank you. Thanks for sharing nap time with us. We know that's a really, really big deal. So thank you.
It's a precious commodity, yes, but no problem. I love spending it with you guys.
Awesome. Well, we like to start by asking our guests a specific question about what it's like for you being a woman in your body at this time and in this place in our world. Can you talk a little bit about that, Cynthia?
Yeah, well, for me, I think that I've recently been through some physical changes in my body, with my body having given birth 8 months ago. So for me, it's, you know, it's like processing the changes. I'm 39 years old, and so I wasn't a young pregnant person. And the whole journey kind of really humbled me, especially physically, because I was under this really naive impression that I would bounce back really quickly. And, you know, I had always kind of taken for granted that I was always really able-bodied and thin and resilient. And, you know, I'm just getting older. And I think that that's also one of those things that I'm processing. I mean, people who are even older than me might scoff at that, but I'm kind of having like this moment where I'm like, wow, I'm really getting older and my body's not as resilient as it used to be. And of course, you know, after giving birth, there's changes that you deal with your body in terms of your weight and the shape of it and all that stuff. So I think, you know, for me personally, I was fortunate growing up that I was always fairly thin. Like, I mean, I don't want to say like being thin is fortunate, because I think that that's a misguided view. I think that I never struggled with weight issues when I was young. However, having said that, when I was in school, like when I was really young and in school, I was always like the really, really, really super skinny girl, like too skinny. And I would be called like chicken legs and stuff like that. And that made me really self-conscious. And it wasn't until I was in my early 20s that I even felt comfortable wearing shorts and skirts. I used to kind of hide my chicken legs with pants all the time. And I grew up with two guys. I grew up with my dad and my brother. So that also didn't help the being averse to wearing skirts and things like that. So, you know, I mean, even being like really, really skinny has its own issues, but you know, and then as I got through my 20s, I was thin. I didn't struggle with weight, but now that I'm 39, you know, my body has reached just a different place. And, so my weight is different. The shape of my body is different. And I'm processing that and learning to be okay with it. The thing that's difficult is that my back has been in some degree of chronic pain for the past year, since about the middle of my pregnancy, up even until now. So that's the part that makes me feel like I'm not as young as I used to be. Mm-hmm. You know, it really took a toll on my body that way.
It's so interesting just how, you know, just recognizing how we feel about the way we move about in the world. It's, I think, just fascinating to get a perspective from different people in different places at different ages. So I thought you nailed it.
I know. Yeah.
Yeah, it is an interesting issue. Yeah. And I think people that are raising daughters, I'm in admiration of them, because I don't, you know, I know it's difficult to cope with like all these media images of these unattainable body types, you know. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's a certainly definitely interesting issue.
Yeah. So let's move into the work that you do. Cynthia, do you want to just kind of give us in a nutshell, your journey to becoming a lawyer?
So I knew when I was in college that I wanted to go to law school. And I think just like a lot of people, I felt that I didn't know a lot of lawyers growing up. My dad is a lawyer now, but he actually went to law school when he was like middle-aged. And he went to a night law school. So, but when I was growing up, I didn't know any lawyers. And I just thought, I think like a lot of people, I just thought it was like a cool, a fascinating, powerful, you know, thing. Like being a lawyer always seemed to have this thing about it, right? So, you know, I knew I wanted to go to law school, and I hadn't really planned for anything else. And when I got to law school, I was a little bit disillusioned, because, you know, you're just really surrounded by a lot of people with big egos. Everybody's trying to outdo each other with how smart they are. And you know, and there's a pecking order with the grading system and all of this. So all of that kind of really detracted from the experience. But I did like a lot of the classes, and it was really enlightening. And then, you know, it seemed like I skipped a year out. When I first graduated from law school, I went to go live in Florida for a year. I wasn't a lawyer right after law school. And then the next year, I finally got licensed and I began my first law job. And I just kind of ended up in an immigration law firm. And that's how I started my career as an immigration attorney.
Okay. And so you said initially you almost not fell into immigration law, but that was just your first job out of law school. That's kind of what drew you there. What has kept you practicing immigration law specifically?
It's been, gosh, next year is 2017, so it's been almost a decade. And during that time, I think what continued to draw me to immigration law is a couple of things. I mean, it's a field where you really feel like you're helping people. So there's that sense of fulfillment that you get, which is, you know, that selfish feeling of why, you know, why does this make me feel good to do this? Because it's not all altruistic work, you know. So there was that sense of fulfillment. And then also, I used to always say to people, you know, being an immigration lawyer is like sitting in a little office, but getting a piece of the world while you're doing it, you know. And I always loved that aspect of it. I love meeting people from different backgrounds and cultures and countries. And so it was perfect for me, you know, for a long time. Everybody just had a different story, fascinating story from where they came from and, you know, what drew them to the United States. And so that, you know, was enduring fascination for me for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about a typical client and what kind of services they're needing from you? Why are they showing up in your office?
I think for me, kind of a typical client, immigration law can be a lot of different things. I mean, there's business visas, you know, there's family unification or reunification type of work where somebody is applying for, you know, their spouse, mother, father, child in another country, bringing them to the United States to join their family. Most of my work has really been kind of either family unification, reunification, or humanitarian, like as in doing asylum. So I would say my sort of typical kind of client, if I can even say that, is someone who comes to my office and wants to know how can they stay in the United States. A lot of times it's somebody who wants to seek asylum here. And a lot of times it's somebody who they are going to apply for a visa through a family member, you know. So that's really kind of the typical kind of client, somebody who's wanting to know how they can stay in the United States.
I've read some of your Facebook posts. You have a Facebook page for your practice, and some of your Facebook posts are heartbreaking. Sometimes you post just kind of about the current climate of immigration, but sometimes you'll post, and you don't get into specifics, obviously, but just a statement on the current situation as a whole in the world. So I often think, gosh, I wonder how she keeps from just losing it when some of those asylum seekers or desperate to keep their family in the United States clients come in. Could you tell us some ways or some reasons why immigration law can be so heartbreaking?
Yeah, I think you kind of touched on that in your question. When people are seeking asylum, a lot of times, you know, they're fleeing persecution from something, from the government, or, you know, from a group of people in the country that they came from that the government cannot control or stop. And a lot of them come to the United States with very, very compelling and terrible stories. So I think that that's what can make it really heartbreaking. There is something that a lot of immigration lawyers who do asylum, they talk about like the vicarious trauma aspect of it. Because when you hear so many horror stories, you know, you really, sometimes it's hard to sleep at night, or, you know, you just kind of can internalize it, and it can be depressing after a while, you know, and you just think when you're faced with that, you know, every day, all the time, then, you know, it can be depressing, and it can affect your worldview. Like, oh my gosh, the world is a terrible place. Like, all these people are coming from these countries where all these horrific things are happening, you know? So I think that that's what can make it heartbreaking and difficult. And you really have to pull back and kind of think about other things, and, you know, so that you can try not to let it get to you sometimes.
How do you do that, Cynthia?
You know, I'm really not that good at doing that. You know, it's interesting that you're asking me this now that I've been doing immigration law for almost 10 years, because I think I've recently come to a place where I'm considering, do I want to keep doing this, or do I want to move into another field of law? I think when you do it for so long, you can also have compassion fatigue, you know, and you don't want to be the lawyer that just doesn't care anymore, because, like, your capacity for caring is just not there. You know, you just don't have it anymore, because it can be exhausting. So I think that, you know, I haven't always been good at also drawing boundaries in my practice. And I've done things for people, honestly, not to make myself sound like a good person or anything like that, but I allow people to draw me into their lives, particularly in, I would say, the first couple of years that I was practicing immigration law and I was doing asylum cases. Working for a very small firm in Tulsa, Oklahoma, I would go do things for people that were outside the boundaries of being a lawyer. I mean, I would pick people up and take them places. I gave people money. Because you get so drawn into people's sad stories and you want to help people. And, you know, those are boundaries that I learned through years that I had to draw, you know, because you will wear yourself out. You will very much reach a point of compassion fatigue where, you know, you can't live it, breathe it all the time. You have to leave it at work and then come home and have your life and your family and everything, you know. You have to learn to reconcile it in that way, you know, because otherwise, yeah, it does wring you out. And so I'm at a point right now where I'm just thinking, like, do I want to keep doing this? I think that I might be ready for a change in the next couple of years. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Still thinking on that, yeah.
So can we talk a little bit in terms of immigration in our current political climate? Is that something that, because you're so close to our nation's capital, I mean, we're all inundated with the happenings of our nation's capital all the time, but is that something that you really feel like is in your face? Is this something that really concerns you or that you feel good about? Or that you devote time to thinking to? I mean, you might just be so wrapped up in your own clients that you don't necessarily want to spend the energy thinking about these kind of overarching systematic things. But I don't know. I'd love to hear.
Well, I think that that's an excellent question. I think mostly being close to the nation's capital hasn't changed kind of what I do very much. I'm a member of an organization called the American Immigration Lawyers Association, and this is the big, reputable, time-honored organization of immigration lawyers from across the country, and they do a lot of advocacy work. They have lobbyists and, you know, just like a think tank, and so they write a lot about immigration. They advocate on Capitol Hill for immigration reform, and they do all this awesome stuff, right? So I've been a member of this organization the entire time I've been an attorney. And like sort of through them, there's always opportunities to do a little something extra, whether it's pro bono work or whether it's, you know, attending citizenship clinics. You know, there's just a myriad of things you can do. And so the only thing that really being in DC kind of adds to that experience is like you can physically go to the Capitol and engage in, like, you know, whether it's, you know, talking to Congress people or attending a protest or, you know, going to the AILA national headquarters. You can do stuff like that here. But kind of going back on something that you mentioned, you know, kind of being so involved with my clients, you know, right now, as you guys are aware, I have a baby. So I am kind of like, I would say 75% devoting my time to being at home with my son, and then the other part of my time being an attorney. So the well of my clientele has gotten a lot smaller. I have just, you know, I'm not doing very many cases right now. So the thing that consumes my time the most is my baby. And kind of to draw this full circle is, you know, those additional opportunities that you might have by living in the Washington, D.C. area to engage in productively in the immigration conversation, those things I really can't do right now. I can't do a lot of things during the day. You know, like I save the time when I leave my house and leave my son in someone else's care for when I'm doing something with my clients. So I can't, like, there's been actually quite a few, like, things happening, like on the grounds of the Capitol. There's been a couple of protests that I wanted to go to, but I just can't do that right now, you know, so.
Right. I think that's so smart. And I think when you have kind of an intense personality, or if you're a passionate person, you kind of feel like you have to do everything 100% all the time. And yeah, it's so smart and so wise to realize you can't do everything 100% all the time. Like, you are clearly in a season with a baby, you know,
right, and it's exactly
it's great that you can still kind of spend that other part of your brain on your few clients that you have right now. So you're still invested in that world and keeping up that part of yourself. But you're absolutely right that we have to know our limits and our priorities in different seasons of life. So I appreciate that answer. I think if I lived in DC, it would be just trouble for me. I feel like I would feel like I would need to show up to everything, but also need to, like, I guess, strap the kids on my back and do it. I don't know what I do.
Yeah, when he gets a little older, maybe I could do that, you know. Yeah.
Well, Leslie would have her kids strapped to her back, but then the next week, no one would hear from her, and she'd be, like, in her corner, not wanting to see a person.
So like, in a fetal position.
Yes.
Right. It's the extreme.
I think it's, like, as women and moms, like, we all kind of go through that. Like, we overextend ourselves, and then we kind of crawl back into the corner, and we're like, okay, I just spent, like, you know, a couple of weeks doing everything I could possibly, reaching out to every single person, right, you know, addressing every cause I could, and then now I'm so spent, you know.
Yes, it's so
exactly
true. So to take it back a little bit to the current political climate, because we are in an election year, a common misconception I hear specifically on social media, which obviously is the best example of a double-edged sword, is that it's easy for immigrants to both get in the United States and to get green cards or some other kind of visas. So tell us what you're seeing as someone who actually works in that field.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question, and something that I wish was more understood. Our immigration system is quite, you know, it is quite complex, and but I think that, you know, to kind of address the political part of it, immigration can be really divisive because I think it's so misunderstood. Politicians often use the fact that it's not understood as a tool, as a way to pander to people, you know. It's actually, you know, our immigration laws are pretty strict. And this idea that people should just come here legally, it just is, you know, so far a mischaracterization of what people are able to do. So, you know, we have business visas and we have family visas to kind of simplify it. And family visas, for instance, like if you're from Mexico and you have a family member that's here in the United States and you want that person to apply for you or petition for you to have an immigrant visa to be able to enter the United States lawfully, if it's not your spouse, for instance, if it's your mother or if it's your sibling, it can take a really, really, really long time for you to get here because we have the Department of State sets a quota of how many visas are available every year. And there's categories, there's preference categories. So, for instance, if you are a U.S. citizen and you're in the United States and you're applying for your sibling who's in Mexico, and say it's like an adult sibling, it could take you something like 10 years for there to even be like a visa available for you to get here because there's a quota system and there's so many people in line ahead of you, you know, and in some cases it takes like 20 years, you know. So, I mean, that's kind of the landscape, right? So when you think about people that live in like underdeveloped countries and they're struggling with, you know, maybe poverty and feeding their family, to say that, you know, first of all, that they even understand how immigration works here, and then to suggest that, you know, they're just going to, like, sit around and wait for 20 years so they can come here lawfully, you know, meanwhile, like, their family might be starving or, you know, whatever the case may be, you can see the disconnect there, you know? That's not going to happen. You're dealing with people who are, in some cases, desperate. So, you know, if you could come to the United States unlawfully and you can go and you can put yourself in a community somewhere here in the United States of similarly situated people where, you know, there's a job available, even if you're not working lawfully, but you can make decent money and you can send some money home to your family, you know, which choice are you going to take? And I think that people, you know, first of all, they fundamentally misunderstand how things work. And second of all, I think that a lot of times we jump to judgment because we don't, like a lot of Americans, I think, you know, at the risk of being very, very critical, are kind of coming from a place of entitlement whenever they point their finger and say, you know, all these people come here illegally. And because I think, first of all, you have to think about what it's like to be that person in another country and to struggle and suffer that way. And then I also think you have to ask yourself, you know, what makes you so entitled to having been born here? You know, and why is that? Why is that an entitlement? You know, how are these? Why are you more entitled to these resources? You know, because when people come here, they do contribute to our economy. So yeah, that was maybe kind of a long answer to your question, but
it was a beautiful answer. It was a very compassionate answer. I'm not sure I'd be able to be as compassionate to people who don't understand the process if I was so in the process the way you are. So I thought it was a beautiful answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think sometimes immigration lawyers, I think we get really frustrated because there's all this dialogue out there that, you know, isn't even really close to what's, you know, the truth of what the process is really like factually. And I think sometimes we need to step back and realize that, you know, people just, they don't understand, you know, they just don't understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So I read in a book once that I can, of course, no longer remember the name of, but it said that it was a character talking about what her mom, some wisdom her mom had given her, that before you judge someone, you need to get to know or meet at least two people that fit that description. So, for example, if you're prone to judge African-Americans, for instance, you need to meet and get to know two different African-Americans before you dig in your heels and claim the entire race as one thing or another. And I often think about that probably more now than ever, and think it could change the way we talk about immigration specifically if we were required to get to know two people or two families that are dealing with it or trying to, you know, become legal in the United States. Do you think that could change it, or is the situation a little more hopeless?
I mean, I think that's a really interesting theory. If I could break it down, first, I want to say that I think there's an inherent danger in, you know, like, say, if you get to know two Black families or two Indian families or, you know, two families that have undocumented people within the family, I think there's an inherent danger in assuming that those two sets of people or families represent an entire population. You know, like, the African American community is extremely diverse, obviously, you know, and, you know, you can say the same for any demographic. However, having said that, I do think that that would certainly be helpful.
Yeah,
I think it's helpful to get to know, you know, anybody, at least a little, if not a lot, before you cast judgment on, you know, that person, that person's demographic, or that, you know, what you think that person might represent just because of what they look like or where they come from or something like that. Yeah, I think that's interesting. And I think that that would probably be helpful if people did that.
Yeah, it is interesting. And I wonder, so many of our neighborhoods are completely not diverse, you know, in America, unless you live in a larger sort of more populated area. So for listeners who don't have access to kind of the other or wouldn't even know where to begin to look for a family who maybe has an undocumented worker or a family that doesn't look like them, like, what do we do, guys? You know, what do you do?
You know, I think I don't pretend to have the answer, honestly, but I do think that sparking an interest in people and things that are different than just the things that they know and see, you know, like if you grow up in one, you know, little town in the Midwest and that's all that you ever see and that's all that you ever know, you may not know what maybe a Chinese immigrant family living in San Francisco is like, or, you know, because you've never been there. So, I mean, I would suggest that to some degree, maybe the solution is rooted in education. You know, maybe we need to have an education system if they're not already doing this, because I don't want to disparage, like, I'm not an educator. That's what I'm trying to say. I'm not a teacher. Right. I don't work in administration. But, like, you know, field trips, you know, asking kids to research other cultures, you know, those kind of things. I think that as our world becomes increasingly interconnected, those things are happening kind of naturally as an evolution, but it's not, you know, like in our country, like, you know, with there's so much xenophobia, people who are scared of things that, you know, are so different from them. I still think we need a lot of that. I think we need a lot of education and to spark curiosity and, you know, sort of, you know, reach your hand across to shake the hand of somebody who's not like you and have a conversation with them.
Yeah, I completely agree. And when you were talking earlier about, I think you said that the world kind of comes to your office, the world comes to you a little bit, just based on your position and what you do for work. But I wonder if we can all sort of think about how we can invite the world into our space, into our office, into our home, and just get creative in how we do that. And I think you're right, like, the priority of sort of a multicultural education, and I don't know, I wonder if that's how you know, art can kind of enhance our lives in so many ways, is just exploring the art of other people, you know, being just sort of being awake to the influences that are out there that we can invite and welcome into our homes.
Exactly. Yeah. And things like, you know, like you mentioned art, things like language, you know, that our country is often criticized by people that come from other countries because we're mostly like a monolingual country, you know, and we seem to have this kind of backlash from a certain segment of the population when you think about introducing other languages substantially, you know, into like the fabric of our society. Yeah, and I think that it's also not sort of like this kumbaya thing, like reach across, you know, get to know somebody, like, you know, a pen pal. Like it's not just like that. I also think that it's really critical in this time of, you know, like terrorism and that kind of thing. I think that, you know, in order to clarify, like, who's really a terrorist and, you know, what is the biggest threat to this country? I think that people need to get to know their Muslim neighbors, you know, to understand that it's not being a Muslim that is a terrorist. It's not, you know, it's not being the Latino family next door. They're the migrant threat from coming. Mm-hmm. From, you know, I mean, I think that it's really critical for us to survive, not just like, you know, not just like existentially, like as people, but like, you know, we want our country to survive. We want our country to be this great immigrant salad bowl. We necessarily have to start understanding each other better if we're going to be able to thrive as a country, you know?
I think you're right. The hardest part, you know, you mentioned people in the middle of Midwest, which is essentially describing me, where I grew up.
And well, so, I lived in the Midwest too, so.
Yeah. Then you can attest too, you have to be way more intentional about those educational pieces in the Midwest than you do in DC. You know, even our exhibits in our museums and things like that can often be very whitewashed. And so, you know, having kids from, actually all three of us have kids from Ethiopia, but it does bring an awareness that you can seriously sense that your neighbors don't have to be they don't have to be aware of that, right? So I think living in the Midwest, you have to be really intentional. But the good news is, because we are so interconnected, it's actually really easy. If you have an internet connection or a library pass, you can get to know different cultures. I just think because we're so interconnected, you have to be intentional, but the options are available. You just really have to kind of dive into other sources of media that are not kind of the 24 hours on your TV. Find these alternative sources like blogs that talk about the experience of other cultures in our country, because they're speaking their truth, and that's when you know it's unedited. And, you know, to consume that kind of media as opposed to the ones on your TV, you'll get a lot more from that. And I think that's kind of the message for Midwesterners. What's helped me is to do that, just be super intentional about finding those little gems.
Yeah, yeah. I think you have to have a spark of curiosity about that too. And I don't know where that comes from exactly, except that, you know, I think that teachers are really, really important in this country. And because, you know, I think about, you know, I think that the vast stuff that's available on the internet is kind of a good and a bad thing, you know, because you have people being recruited into, you know, whether it's these psycho white supremacist groups or ISIS, you know, there's all kinds of stuff to be found on the internet. I think that, you know, this just occurred to me while you were saying that it was after some mass shooting in our country. I read this blog post that had an uncharacteristic take on the solution to, like, these lone wolf, you know, guys with guns that just shoot people. And it primarily, like, the demographic was the white guy, like the crazy white guy that takes a gun and he goes and, you know, mows people down with a firearm. But the post was talking about what are the root issues that this person has dealt with. And one of the things that this post said that I thought was really interesting was this idea of being disconnected, right? So this idea of being lonely and disconnected. And his suggestion was that one thing we all need to do is, you know, we're kind of an increasingly fractured society, you know, and we need to become more communal was essentially what he was saying, you know, like, go talk to your neighbor if they're lonely, you know, go talk to somebody, you know, these people are, you know, maybe some of them suffer from mental illness, maybe some of them are just racist jerks, you know, I mean, but fundamentally, like, these people were isolated, you know, and increasingly our society is becoming isolated and there's a lot of these people. So his whole point was, which I thought was really interesting, and it's idealistic, yes, to some degree, but I mean, it was about like, reach out to that person that's, you know, on your apartment floor that looks really lonely, or whoever, that person in your office building that never gets invited to anything, or, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that in order to do that, it goes back to what you were talking about earlier of just not trying to do everything all at once. Like, you have to intentionally make room for that in your life. If you're running around managing 10,000 things, then you're not even going to notice your neighbor. You're not even going to notice the sad guy, you know, down the hall. And so, I agree with you, but I also think that that takes some work, that takes some, like, the thought needs to become the action, you know, and we need to
part. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I think, and kind of my point to that was, and I totally agree with you, like, we're so busy. Everybody's so busy, you know, we just get so caught up in our own busy lives. But, I think kind of it goes back to just talking about connecting with people and understanding each other. I mean, really, you know, I mean, I don't have the answers, but, you know, like, how, you know, how do you get to know who African Americans are? You know, go talk to somebody, you know, like, really just go talk to somebody, go have a conversation with somebody, you know?
When you were talking about community and how important it is and how that can change kind of the almost diabolical nature of some of these mass shootings, the potential to change it, I should say, it reminded me.
Well, I thought it was an interesting idea.
It is. You know? No.
That's what I thought. I hadn't seen that, like, proposed anywhere else.
Well, and you're a new mom again. And so you, I'm sure, because I vividly remember when I was a new mom, how lonely and isolating being a new mom can be. And how important community is in those situations when you're maybe a little more prone to, I mean, you're inside with your baby for hours on end, not seeing people, and just how life-giving community can be. And you have such a great supportive community around you. And we actually talk a lot on Mama Bear Dares about the importance of community. And really, that's kind of our goal as a podcast, is to be one of the communities that women can be a part of in their lives too. And I love seeing you're an Ethiopian adoptive mom as well. And like, you have a remarkable group of women who kind of formed a community from the Ethiopian adoption world. And so maybe just speak for a second on what that meant to you when you were going through the adoption.
Yes, that's a really good question. Shout out to all those ladies that, if they hear this, were, like, I could tear up talking about it because they were so critical, you know, in my life for, like, a really long time, and they've become really good friends. Yeah, to have somebody that really identifies with the experience that you're going through, because, you know, adopting a child from Ethiopia is not everybody's, you know, it's not the garden variety experience, right? I mean, it's something unique, and to have found friends that were like-minded in many ways and supportive, you know, and lended an ear and lended a shoulder and shared their experiences with you, and you could lend your ear and your shoulder, and all of that was, like, super important. And, you know, during many moments of, you know, the past 7 years, really critical, you know, I think, to surviving in a way, you know,
in like that sort of metaphorical way, like as a mother, to just feel like to come out on the other side and think that everything's going to be okay when you're having those really, really dark moments and you're like, I don't know if I can get through this, you know? Yeah. So community, I think, especially when you're going through something unique, to have people reach out to people that identify with your experience, I think it's really, really, really important. You know, whether it's Ethiopian adoption or whether it's, you know, even, you know, whether it's something else, whether it's pregnancy, whether it's moving across the country and going to a new city, you know, yeah, you know, whatever it is. I mean, could name a million examples. You know?
So you're married to an Ethiopian man, and I'm wondering how that kind of has changed or influenced your thoughts on immigration or solidified them, or how has that kind of played into your life story?
Yeah, so I mean, we connected, you know, on a lot of levels, you know, immigration being one of them. So he is a lawyer. He got a law degree when he was in Ethiopia, and he practiced law there. And he had also written a book about migrants. So that was, you know, that was a major point of connection between us.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, so he understands it, you know, on a really intimate level, because he comes from a country that obviously has a lot of outbound migration. He understands the reasons for that. And he also understands it from, like, an intellectual level, because he's studied it. So, like, the push and pull factors of migration. So, yeah, I mean, he has a really nuanced, you know, smart point of view about it. And, you know, we do have some fascinating discussions. So I think, you know, how is that? I think that that's just enriched kind of my perspective on migration and, you know, what happens in the world and everything. That's sort of, yeah, expanded and enriched my understanding, you know.
Yeah, I would love to be at your dinner table and hear those.
Yeah, he's awesome. So when you come through DC, come have dinner with us.
I can't.
Obviously, he's my husband and I'm in love with him, so I have a lot of really good things to say about him. He's really smart, though, and he's really interesting. So
I'd be really interested in the practice of gender roles in your marriage, because you come from two different cultures, and what that looks like in our culture. So there's almost three different aspects going on.
Yeah, that's a good question. My husband, he does come from a society that I think we all think of as a patriarchal society, but he doesn't really embody those kind of characteristics, as you might imagine, since he's married to me. So he's not like that, essentially.
Yeah.
The only thing I will say is, you know, it's kind of interesting because in Ethiopia, you know, cooking is what women do. Mm-hmm. And my husband does not cook at all, because, as he describes it, you know, he was always, if he even stepped foot in the kitchen growing up, like, he was shooed out, mm-hmm. you know, because that's like a woman's domain. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, as a result, he never learned to do anything in the kitchen, and which is fine because he's like awesome at everything else he does. And to my discredit, you know, when he wants to learn to cook something, I have such little patience that I'm just like, no, you're not doing it right. Just get out of the kitchen. I'll do it. You know? So that's kind of how that works.
It sounds like it could be a chapter, like, in his next book, like, Shoot Out of the Kitchen.
Shoot Out of the Kitchen. Yeah, Shoot Out of the Kitchen in Ethiopia. Shoot Out of the Kitchen in the United States. You know, he just doesn't cook. He never learned how. And I'm kind of thwarting his, you know, any desire he has to learn, because I have such little patience with teaching people anything. That's why I'm not a teacher, you know. Like, I'm just like, I'll do it myself.
Yes. Oh, yes.
So, Cynthia, we always like to encourage our moms to not just, you know, be good to their mama self, but also to their own self, their mother self, and their other self. So what are things that you're doing right now that kind of help you nurture that other side of yourself?
Right now? And I don't do it as much as I would like to. I think just what I've always done, I think, to kind of nurture my other self is, you know, exercise, do things that just get back to the passions that I always had, like artwork and reading, those kind of things.
Yeah, just, you know, I think getting back to the passion that you, any mom, any person that's a woman, you know, just had in and of themselves before they became a mom, you know, like getting back to that thing. What was that thing that you love to do? And doing a little bit of that, kind of sprinkling that throughout your life, if you can.
Yeah, speaking of reading, I know you have a little baby, but are you reading anything interesting right now?
I'm trying. I just picked up The Enchantress of Florence by Salman Rushdie. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a little bit thick to start, like in terms of the wording, it's a little bit wordy, but I just started it. I'm like on page 3, so I don't know. Yeah. Like I tend to, like, you know, I don't know if you guys experience this, but like, you know, as you get older and you have kids and stuff, and you're, the time alone that you have to read becomes so much more limited. Mm-hmm. Like you can't stay in a book that's not grabbing your attention right away. Mm-hmm. You know, you're compelled to go back and pick that book up. So, yeah. So I become very choosy. Like if something's not grabbing my attention, I just toss it aside. And you know?
Yeah, I'm the same way. And I wasn't always like that. I would, you know, I felt like I really needed to give the book a fair shot, like at least 5 or 6 chapters, you know. But now I have no time for that.
Yeah, no attention for that anymore. I used to force myself to get through books. Like, oh, this book is like legendary. I have to read it, you know, even if it's like boring me to tears. But now I'm just like, screw it.
Yeah. Cynthia, seriously, thank you so much. If I didn't talk very much, it was because I was just struck by the information. I was trying to just consume all of it and take it all in. So I thank you so much for giving us your nap time, your baby's nap time.
Yeah. Thanks so much for calling. It was really fun to spend time with you guys.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks, Cynthia. It was great.
Mama Bears, today we dare you to get intentional about listening to the stories of the other. In our digital world, it is so easy to isolate yourself from people who are having different life experiences than yours. But we just encourage you to be purposeful about not doing that. In some ways, it might be easier to only surround yourself with people who look like you, think like you, and behave like you. But the reality is that kind of life makes for a muted one. On Mama Bear Dares, we want to embrace a life that is chock full of vibrancy, and we do that by allowing the stories of our fellow sisters and brothers from around the world to find a place in our story. To not turn our backs on the marginalized, and by living our lives with our eyes and our hearts wide open. Mama Bears, it's so hard not to live a life of fear when we receive constant messaging to do so, but today we just dare you to live a life of love and compassion.
That's right. Have a great week, Mama Bears.
Have a great week.
Clip show.
We haven't said that in so long.
I know. Clip show. The show. Peace out, Mama Bears.